Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it's Thursday, March 4th, and we're finishing up Chapter 7, and pretty much we're talking about ligand-gated channels. All right, last time we did talk about the difference between EPSPs and IPSPs. All right, and so what does ESPE mean? EPSP. What does that mean? Yeah, so it's some kind of potential, which means that some kind of voltage, excitatory postsynaptic potential. So it's going to be on the postsynaptic neuron. And so, what kind of potential is that? Is that an action potential or a graded potential? It's a graded potential, so it's going to die away. And an EPSP is going to cause depolarization or hyperpolarization? Depolarization is an excitatory event, right? Hyperpolarization is an inhibitory event on a neuron. What kind of channels produce excitatory events? What would you guess? Because we want to depolarize. We want to reduce the negativity inside the cell. So what kind of ion, which way does it have to move to decrease the negativity inside of a cell? Okay, a good example would be sodium entering the cell. So a sodium channel would be a good example, and in particular, a ligand-gated sodium channel might become activated. And that's going to produce an EPSP because that's going to cause depolarization in this area, and that's going to flow with decrement into the trigger zone. All right, so last time we looked at one particular kind of ligand-gated channel, and it was the signaling molecule was acetylcholine, and the kind of ligand-gated channel that we were looking at was called a nicotinic type channel. All right, so let me get the slideshow working. I'm almost to the point to where I know what I want to talk about now. Okay, so here is acetylcholine. Where does this acetylcholine come from? All right, let me back up a little bit. Where do we find that membrane protein on this diagram that we have on the board? Where are you going to find that membrane protein? Are we going to have it on the axon, the sending part of a neuron, or the receiving end? Yeah, so it's going to be found on dendrites or maybe on the cell body, and it's going to be sensitive to, it's going to change state, it can go from closed to open, right, when a ligand binds to these receptor sites right here. And the only one that can really bind is acetylcholine because of the shape of that molecule. When acetylcholine binds these two molecules, then sodium is going to rush into the cell, right, due to the electrochemical gradient. And as sodium rushes into the cell, that causes depolarization or an excitatory event, or an EPSP. So that's typical of a nicotinic type receptor. So this is just a what we call an ionotropic kind of receptor. It's just going to let ions move across the membrane. All right, so the receptor is not part of the ion channel. It's a one subunit membrane polypeptide, and it activates the channel this is a different kind of receptor protein. All right, so G protein coupled channels are different than these ionotropic. These are going to change some kind of metabolism in the cell indirectly via G proteins. So these are still acetylcholine receptors. Right here you see acetylcholine binding to a receptor molecule which is coupled to these G proteins. And you can probably remember from the first test that when this first messenger binds to the receptor molecule, it activates these G proteins that dissociate from the receptor molecule, and they can move by diffusion within the surface of the plasma membrane. So they move around on the inner surface of the plasma membrane, and this beta and gamma subunit right here can bump into another membrane protein, and this is a potassium channel, which is normally closed. All right, but when the beta and gamma subunit bind to the potassium channel, it opens up, and now potassium can go from high concentration to low concentration. It can leave the cell. All right, and what does that cause in the cell? When positive ions leave, what happens to the electrical voltage inside the cell? It becomes more negative. What do we call that? That's hyperpolarization, right? Or maybe repolarization. But in every case, is that excitatory or is that going to be inhibitory on the cell? That's going to be inhibitory. So this kind of mechanism right here produces IPSPs, or inhibitory postsynaptic potentials. All right, now where does this acetylcholine signaling molecule come from? What kind of cell membrane are we looking at right here? A presynaptic neuron or a postsynaptic neuron? So on the screen, we have a postsynaptic neuron. Where does acetylcholine come from? The presynaptic neuron. All right, so I'm just trying to have you use some of that terminology. Okay, so we saw that the nicotinic type receptor typically is excitatory, right? Like this one right here, because it causes depolarization. And this muscarinic type acetylcholine receptor can be inhibitory, right? Because it's opening this potassium channel, causing hyperpolarization. All right. So when acetylcholine is released from a presynaptic neuron and binds to this receptor right here, do you think it's a good idea to have a long duration of action or a short duration of action? And I'll maybe give you an example of a really severe kind of condition. All right, maybe you were in a dark room and you want to be using your vision system so that you can see something. And we're in a dark room and I turn a flashlight on, and what do you see? A bright flash of light. Okay. Now, do you want to spend the rest of your life just experiencing that bright flash of light, or would you like that stimulus to actually attenuate and go away so that maybe you could see something new in the future? Yeah, because you're going to want to change your position, right? So the neurotransmitter should be degraded. It should actually decompose and go away so that the postsynaptic neuron could be stimulated again when there is a new circumstance, right? So the action of neurotransmitters should be limited. Acetylcholine's action is limited by an enzyme that's in the postsynaptic membrane that's called acetylcholinesterase. And probably you would know that that's an enzyme because you see what, an ASE on the end of that word. And so you know it is an enzyme. And you know the substrate because it's in the word acetylcholine. Okay, so acetylcholinesterase breaks acetylcholine down into choline molecules and acetate. Have you ever seen acetate anywhere before? Yeah, that's what's produced with what? The preparatory reaction as pyruvate enters the mitochondria, right? So that's a very familiar molecule. That can be used to make all kinds of things. Can be used to build fatty acids, can be used to fuel the Krebs cycle, or can be resynthesized in this presynaptic cell to make what? More acetylcholine. All right, so that's an important degradation pathway. Acetylcholine is inactivated, terminating its action, right, and it's located in the synaptic cleft. All right, so let's consider some other kinds of neurotransmitters. Any kind of neuron that uses acetylcholine is what we call a cholinergic neuron because it uses acetylcholine. Even the large synapses in skeletal muscle, right, are basically cholinergic. They use acetylcholine. That kind of synapse at the neuromuscular synapse we call neuromuscular junctions. These are huge synapses. And acetylcholine is released from a motor neuron onto a muscle. And because the synapse is so large, right, that is always going to produce, well, acetylcholine is going to produce EPSPs because it's a nicotinic kind of receptor. Remember, nicotinic receptor opens up a sodium channel. And there are so many sodium channels that when a motor neuron releases acetylcholine, it produces a massive depolarization on a skeletal muscle cell, right? Which is always going to produce an action potential on a muscle cell, which means that a muscle cell is always going to contract. A muscle cell can't make up its mind. A skeletal muscle cell can't make up its mind whether it's going to contract or not. If it gets a signal from a motor neuron, it just automatically contracts. Unlike a postsynaptic neuron can make up its mind because it has a trigger zone right here. But the depolarization on a skeletal muscle cell is so massive that a muscle cell is always going to contract. All right, and that's probably a good thing, because if you tell your skeletal muscle system to lift up this bottle of water and take a drink, you want to have a skeletal muscle cell have the ability to make up its own mind whether or not it wants to contract. No, because skeletal muscle is what? Voluntary. It's under voluntary control. It's under the control of your nervous system. Okay. There are monoamine neurotransmitters, which include serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine. All right, serotonin is derived from tryptophan. Anybody recognize tryptophan? Have we seen tryptophan before? What kind of molecule is tryptophan? That is an amino acid. That's an amino acid, a very standard amino acid, but it is one that your body cannot synthesize. That means that we call it an essential amino acid, and it has to be in your diet. All right, so diet might play a role in whether or not your body can synthesize these neurotransmitters, right? And which then is going to influence how neurons will communicate with each other. Even norepinephrine and dopamine are derived from a different amino acid, tyrosine, but that also is an essential amino acid. Right, so your neurotransmitters can be influenced by your diet, depending on what kind of diet you have. And what kind of diet gives you all of the essential amino acids easily? Yeah, like an animal-type protein, right? Not a plant-type protein. They're usually deficient unless you're aware of what kinds of plants have tyrosine and what kinds of plants have tryptophan. And if you combine them together in your diet at the same time, then what? Then you have basically an animal protein. All right, so culture teaches us, right, your own particular culture teaches us how you can combine plant material to have a complete protein. Like, what would you have to combine in your diet? If you eat just rice, that's not good. And if you eat just beans, that's not good. But if you have rice and beans together, right, that gives you all of the amino acids that you need to live a healthy life, and you don't have to consume animal protein necessarily. All right, so all of these neurotransmitters right here are called catecholamines as opposed to acetylcholine. All right, so here is a synapse that's run by monoamine neurotransmitters. All right, so an action potential comes down the presynaptic neuron. That's going to activate voltage-gated calcium channel. So calcium enters the cell. And the amount of calcium that enters the cell is going to depend on how is intensity regulated in a neuron again? Is it by the amplitude of an action potential? No, by the frequency of action potentials, right? So if there's a high rate of action potentials reaching this axon terminus, a lot of calcium can enter the cell, right? If there's a very slow rate of action potentials, then you're going to have a very small amount of calcium entering the cell. So calcium entry is directly related to the frequency of action potentials, which is directly related to stimulus intensity. All right, so this calcium molecule is going to cause the fusion of these vesicles that contain norepinephrine to the presynaptic neuron, and then release of that neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. And here you can see a metabolic pathway where norepinephrine is made from tyrosine right here, right? It's converted into DOPA, then dopamine, and then the active neurotransmitter. So the amount of norepinephrine that's released into the synaptic cleft is directly related to or not related to or inversely related to the number of action potentials reading the axon terminus right here. Yeah, as the frequency increases, the amount of norepinephrine that's released increases, right? So it's directly related to it. So then norepinephrine is going to move across the synaptic cleft and bind to these receptors right here. Now, what kind of receptor does that kind of look like to you? Look at this little thing hanging down over here. Does that kind of look like just a simple ligand-gated channel or maybe a G-protein-coupled receptor? All right, if we go way back over here, look at this. All right, anytime you see that, that's going to represent a G-protein coupled type receptor. All right, so as the frequency of action potentials increases, then we have more norepinephrine binding to more and more of these G-protein-coupled receptors, and that these G-protein-coupled receptors can then cause depolarization or hyperpolarization depending on the frequency of action potentials from this presynaptic neuron. All right, so frequency of action potentials in the presynaptic neuron is directly related to the level of stimulation in the postsynaptic neuron because more receptors are binding the neurotransmitter. All right, and this particular neurotransmitter, of course, you don't want to have a long life, right? You want to attenuate its response. And so norepinephrine is not metabolized on the postsynaptic membrane like acetylcholine is, but it's taken back up by the presynaptic neuron. So we call that reuptake of neurotransmitter from the synaptic cleft into the axon terminus, where norepinephrine is broken down and inactivated by monoamine oxidase. So monoamine oxidase attenuates or stops the effect of neurotransmitter on the postsynaptic cell. So what would be the enzyme that works for acetylcholine? What's the name of the enzyme that stops the action of acetylcholine at the synapse? It's not monoamine oxidase, it would be acetylcholinesterase. All right, so there's a little bit of a difference. And where monoamine oxidase is in the presynaptic cell, where do you find acetylcholinesterase? On the postsynaptic membrane. So the mechanism is a little bit different between these different kinds of neurotransmitters. Okay, it is also inactivated to some degree by another enzyme that's called COMT, which then also attenuates the effects of norepinephrine. All right, all monoamine neurotransmitters don't bind to simple ligand-gated ion channels, right? But they bind to G-protein-coupled receptors. All right, so norepinephrine binds to a receptor that activates these subunits, and the alpha subunit can bump into an enzyme, another enzyme, in the plasma membrane that we call adenylate cyclase. All right, and the job of adenylate cyclase is to take ATP and chop off the two terminal phosphate groups, functional groups. Well, as a matter of fact, how many phosphate functional groups does ATP have on it? It's got three, right? One right next to the other. So adenylate cyclase chops off the terminal two, and that leaves just one functional phosphate group on adenosine, and that's called AMP. But it leaves it in a special configuration so that it forms a ring. So we call that cyclic AMP. It has a special kind of structure, right? And then cyclic AMP, when it builds up inside the cell, can bind to a protein kinase, right, and activate it. What's the job of a protein kinase? It's going to phosphorylate various proteins, and it can change the activity of these proteins, maybe enzymes that are inside the cell, or maybe ion channels inside the cell. All right, so cyclic AMP is another messenger, right? So we have a first messenger and a second messenger on this particular slide right here. Where do we always find the first messenger? Outside the cell, like norepinephrine would be the specific example of a first messenger, and it's going to cause the buildup of a second messenger inside the cell, which is what we're going to call cyclic AMP in this particular case. All right, so where do you find cyclic AMP? Inside the cell, only inside the cell? As a matter of fact, yes. And what about the first messenger? Where are you going to find that? And only outside the cell? And you're going to say, well, yeah. Okay, so first messenger is always outside the cell. Second messenger is always inside the cell. All right, so this protein kinase might phosphorylate proteins inside the cytoplasm of the cell and change the metabolism in the cell, maybe by opening up certain kinds of metabolic pathways. Or this protein kinase might phosphorylate an ion channel, causing it to open up. All right, so in that particular case, this ion channel, if it's a sodium channel, it's going to produce an excitatory event, right? Sodium is going to enter the cell, but if it's a potassium channel, it's going to do what to this cell? It's going to inhibit the cell. So these G-protein coupled receptors, depending on exactly the mechanism right here, right, that can either be excitatory or inhibitory. But here is something else that's really important about this slide. I'm not sure that your book talks about it, but here is an enzyme called adenylate cyclase, and what is it producing? Yeah, that cyclic AMP, which is the second messenger inside the cell. So now the signal has been transduced from a norepinephrine signal from outside the cell to a cyclic AMP signal inside the cell. So that's signal transduction, changing the signal. Okay. But what can you tell me about an enzyme when it catalyzes a reaction? Does it get used up? It does not get used up, right? So as soon as this adenylate cyclase gets turned on, how many cyclic AMPs can it make? Thousands and thousands and thousands of second messengers inside the cell, right? And what started that production of all those thousands of cyclic AMPs? How many molecules of norepinephrine? Yeah, you see just one molecule of norepinephrine. So one signaling, one first messenger signal can produce what? Thousands and thousands of second messengers inside the cell. What do we call that when you take a small signal and make a big signal out of it? And we all like that. Because if you saw me driving into the parking lot this morning, you would see my rearview mirrors doing what? Vibrating back and forth. What was I using inside my car? Yeah, an amplifier, right? I was amplifying a small signal and making it a big signal. All right, so this G protein right here is a step of amplification. It can amplify this very small norepinephrine signal and make it a big cyclic AMP signal. Furthermore, all right, what about this protein kinase right here? When it phosphorylates proteins, does it become inactivated? Does an enzyme get used up when it catalyzes a reaction? No, it doesn't, right? So here is what? A second step of amplification because the protein kinase doesn't get used up. So just one signaling molecule can have a profound effect inside the cell because of this cascade mechanism. So a cascade mechanism has different levels of amplification to turn a small signal into a gigantic signal inside the cell to change the metabolism or the electrical properties of this cell in a big way because of this cascade mechanism. Okay. All right, serotonin is involved in regulation of mood, behavior, appetite, and maybe even circulation in the brain. LSD, you guys haven't even heard of that probably, is structurally similar to serotonin. That used to be a really popular drug when I was growing up. Okay. And serotonin, all right, is important in producing proper moods, right, and is associated with clinical depression. So depleted levels of serotonin can produce clinical depression. So there are some pharmacological agents that can block the reuptake of serotonin from the synaptic cleft. So serotonin lives a longer life in the synaptic cleft, so it can bind for a longer period of time on G proteins, producing what? A longer lasting effect in the postsynaptic neuron. All right, so some of these serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors are like Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, all right, and they just block the reuptake of serotonin, prolonging its action, and that really is beneficial to many, many patients. Okay, dopamine, you should at least know that that's a neurotransmitter, but I'm not going to talk about this slide right here. I should probably actually delete this slide, unless somebody's really interested in it. Okay, norepinephrine is another monoamine. It's used both in the peripheral nervous system and central nervous system. In the peripheral nervous system, you should know that it is primarily a sympathetic autonomic nervous system neurotransmitter. Okay, is that on there? Yeah, it's a sympathetic neurotransmitter. In the central nervous system, it affects the general level of arousal. All right, and is also involved in mood, and so it is also associated with clinical depressions. And amphetamines have a similar structure and can stimulate norepinephrine pathways. There are some other kinds of neurotransmitters, which we call amino acid neurotransmitters. For instance, glutamic acid and aspartic acid are major central nervous system excitatory neurotransmitters. All right, so glutamic acid and aspartic acid are going to work with what kind of channels? They're going to open up, if they're excitatory, they're going to open up sodium channels, all right? But In order for your nervous system to work properly, think of your skeletal system. Okay, if you want to have precise control and balance, say over your fingertip, like tomorrow night, you're driving home after happy hour, right, and you get pulled over by that person in the fancy blue uniform and the badge, the sidearm and all that, and they say, place your fingertip on your nose with your eyes closed, like that, or close to like that, okay? Okay, how are you able to accomplish that task? Which is probably the most important concept in this class, is what? Is antagonism. Even at the musculoskeletal level, in order to have precise control and balance over this fingertip, you need at least two muscles. And how do these two muscles work with each other? Antagonistically or in opposition to each other, right? So you need a biceps for flexion, you need a triceps for extension, and when they're both under the control of your mind, you have nice control of your fingertips. So you need antagonism. So in the nervous system, there are antagonistic neurotransmitters and nervous systems, right? So if you have an excitatory neurotransmitter, you should also have inhibitory neurotransmitters, right, that work in opposition to excitatory systems. All right, so glycine is one, and gamma-aminobutyric acid, or what we call GABA, that's another inhibitory neurotransmitter. Right, so glutamic acid and aspartate work through sodium ion channels, but glycine and GABA work through either potassium channels or chloride channels by opening up chloride channels. Now, can you remember from the first test, where do you have a high concentration of chloride ions? Inside or outside? You know they're high concentration outside the cell. So that if you open up a chloride channel, guess what? Chlorine goes in because it's almost at zero concentration inside the cell. So chloride ion goes in. What's going to happen to the membrane potential as chloride enters the cell? Is it going to be stimulatory or inhibitory? It's inhibitory because it's going to produce hyperpolarization, right? It's going to add to the negativity inside the cell, thereby inhibiting these cells. Right, so these are really important pathways, even though they're inhibitory and work antagonistically to other excitatory neurotransmitters. But you need both to have what? Precise control and balance of your nervous system. Just like you would never think of driving your car with just an accelerator. You need a brake pedal as well. All right, so there are various chemicals like strychnine that blocks specifically glycine receptors in the spinal cord. And that's a very potent kind of poison, because once there are neurons that are excited in the spinal cord, they never become inhibited, and that just excites everybody's somatic nervous system to where all the muscles in their body go into spasm, go into contracture. So it's a really nasty kind of poison, and we can't unblock those muscles once they contract. Okay, there are nuclei in the brain that degenerate, and the GABA neurons degenerate, and that produces Huntington's disease, which is characterized by a very rigid kind of posture. You don't have control of your body because you can't relax, what, the antagonistic muscles. So if you contract the biceps, what muscle has to be inhibited in order to contract the biceps? The triceps has to be inhibited. But somebody with Huntington's disease, they can't relax the antagonistic muscles, so they don't have very good control over their posture or motion as a result of that. All right, let's see if we can tie some more concepts together right here. All right, so EPSPs are produced by what kind of membrane proteins? Are like voltage-gated proteins or ligand-gated? Okay, ligand-gated. And what part of a neuron has ligand-gated channels? The receiving end, which is what? Dendrites and cell body. Okay. And an EPSP is going to produce depolarization. So a good way to explain that would be a sodium channel that is opening up. So EPSPs are, we said, are graded in magnitude. They have no threshold. They always cause depolarization. They can summate. And since they can summate, they have no refractory period. All right, so here we have a nice diagram of membrane potential versus time, and we see the receiving end of a neuron right here. I see dendrites and cell bodies, and then here's the sending end, right? And here's a nice synapse. And maybe there's just a nice nicotinic ligand-gated channel. So when this presynaptic neuron releases acetylcholine, it binds to that nicotinic receptor. That opens up a sodium channel. And what's that going to do to the membrane right in this area right here? That's going to cause the resting membrane potential to go closer to zero. We call that depolarization. And then that graded potential is going to flow down into the axon hillock right here. Right? And we see that if these graded potentials, by the time they reach the axon hillock, if they don't reach threshold, then there is no action potential. But if it reaches threshold at the axon hillock, that's going to cause an action potential in this axon right here. All right, so this is the mode of action of an EPSP. Let me look at this next slide. All right, so let's talk about spatial summation. So here we have two presynaptic neurons, all terminating on this one postsynaptic neuron. And we got a couple of different cases. Here's case one, here's case two over here. And we see a depolarization. A depolarization produces what kind of event? Yeah, excitatory postsynaptic potential. And give me an example of what kind of ligand-gated channel is being activated right here, like a sodium channel, for instance, right? So that produces an EPSP. And by the time it reaches the axon hillock, okay, is it a subthreshold or a threshold stimulus? Here's the threshold. Here's the EPSP. Is that going to cause an action potential if that reaches the axon hillock? No, it's not. So here's a subthreshold EPSP. All right. So if only one neuron is releasing acetylcholine, it produces a subthreshold stimulus. But if both of these neurons, all right, and maybe they're coming from very distant parts of the body, right, many different kinds of signals, they both come to this postsynaptic neuron, and they both release acetylcholine at the same time, what can happen to these graded potentials, these EPSPs? They can now summate together to where they reach threshold, right, and now an action potential can take place. All right, so this is what we call spatial summation. It happens when EPSPs from different synapses occur on the postsynaptic cell at the same time. And each of these EPSPs might be subthreshold, but because graded potentials can summate, right, that can produce a threshold potential, and an action potential will ensue as a result of that. All right, so that's spatial summation. Temporal summation occurs because EPSPs occur closely in time, can sum before they fade away. So if, I don't know if I have a slide of this, I sure don't, but let's just say we just have one neuron right here, right? If the rate of action potentials reaching this axon terminus is sufficiently high, right, then that's going to increase this EPSP to the point to where it might reach threshold by the time it gets to the axon hillock right here. All right, so if sufficient action potentials reach the axon hillock, right, that can produce a threshold potential. And that's what we call temporal summation as opposed to spatial summation. So what's making a decision whether or not this action potential develops in the axon right here? What's making a decision? Yeah, what do we call that area that makes a decision? I'm not sure I heard it. In terms of a response loop, what part of a response loop makes a decision? The integration center. What does an integration center have? It's got a set point, right? So this neuron really has all those same kinds of elements, right? It can make up its mind whether or not it makes a decision to produce an action potential or not. What's the set point? You could think of the threshold voltage as being the set point, right? That, and what part of a neuron is the integration center? The axon hillock, because that's where you first start to see those, what kind of channels? Are they ligand-gated channels or voltage-gated? The voltage-gated channels, right, have the threshold voltage, right? So each neuron, or these multipolar neurons, can decide, because they have an integration center right here with a threshold voltage, whether or not an action potential is going to come down this axon. Okay. All right, but don't forget, there are other kinds of postsynaptic potentials, right? There, not only are there EPSPs, but there are IPSPs. All right, so here we have a different kind of circuit. Neuron number one is an inhibitory neuron. It's going to release an inhibitory neurotransmitter, and probably you should have on the tip of your tongue maybe an example or two of an inhibitory neurotransmitter. What's an inhibitory neurotransmitter? Give me the name of one. Okay. Yeah, possibly some of those could under certain circumstances, but a really good example that is almost 100% all the time, no matter where you look in the nervous system, would be GABA or glycine, right? Those would be traditionally the neurotransmitter that will be always inhibitory. And since they're inhibitory, when they're released on the postsynaptic cell, what are they going to produce? Depolarization or hyperpolarization? Hyperpolarization, and they could be opening up potassium channels or chloride channels, right? Either one of those two. So that's going to drive the postsynaptic neuron farther away from threshold, thereby inhibiting the cell. Meaning, when I say inhibit this, the postsynaptic neuron, what does that mean? It's going to inhibit the production of an action potential at the axon hillock right here. So when we say inhibit the cell, it means it's going to inhibit the production of an action potential. Okay? Okay. So if we have two neurons, neuron number one might produce an IPSP. Neuron number two might work with a different kind of neurotransmitter and produce an EPSP. All right, so we can see that IPSPs and EPSPs will cancel each other out. So that if neuron number one isn't sending information, only neuron number two, this EPSP would be a threshold stimulus. Right, so this integration center will look for information from many, many sources, many different neurons in the body to make a decision whether or not to send an action potential down to the axon terminus right here. Okay, and so IPSPs will produce what we call synaptic inhibition. There's another condition that I'm going to show you on the next slide that's called presynaptic inhibition, right? We call this postsynaptic inhibition because where are these IPSPs and EPSPs mixing together? Are they mixing together in the presynaptic neuron or the postsynaptic neuron? Here's the presynaptic neuron, here's the postsynaptic neuron. Where do you see these potentials right here? IP, that's what? Inhibitory postsynaptic potential, right? So that's in the postsynaptic cell. Excitatory postsynaptic potential, those are in the postsynaptic cell. So this right here is an example of postsynaptic inhibition. Right? Presynaptic inhibition can also take place. Let's look at this slide right here. So what cell is this? That's the postsynaptic neuron. Right? And what neurons are these over here? These are the presynaptic neurons, right? So here we have a number of presynaptic neurons. Here's the postsynaptic neuron. And this particular neuron, all right, is going to be producing an IPSP, right? And so that's going to produce a postsynaptic inhibition. Here is another neuron that is releasing inhibitory neurotransmitter, and you can see it going to a dendrite that's going to cause postsynaptic inhibition, but look, there's a collateral right here that goes to the axon of another cell. What kind of cell is this one? Is this a postsynaptic cell or a presynaptic cell? That's a presynaptic cell. So this inhibitory neuron is going to release inhibitory neurotransmitter on this presynaptic neuron, inhibiting this presynaptic neuron so that an action potential can't traverse this junction right here. Therefore, it won't cause release of inhibitory neurotransmitter on the postsynaptic neuron. All right, so the blocking of an action potential presynaptically is what we call presynaptic inhibition. All right, so what kind of dendrite is this right here? You learned this in anatomy. What kind of dendrite is this? I'm sorry. What kind of synapse is this right here? This is a axo-somatic synapse, right? Because here's the axon terminus ending on the soma of a neuron. What kind of synapse is this right here? Axodendritic synapse. And what kind of synapse is this one right here? This is a real strange one. This is the axoaxonic synapse. So axoaxonic synapses can cause presynaptic inhibition, right? Or if it's excitatory, I suppose it could even cause presynaptic excitation as well, but mostly inhibition is what we're interested in. Oh, so that's the last slide. All right, so that's it for the test. And you have some quantitative questions at the end of this chapter as well. So I'll probably put the answer keys in Blackboard for those, but I don't think any of them require a calculator. I think they just require that you know how to read a graph. All right, so those are actually pretty easy to do. All right, but I'll put my answers in Blackboard for you to look at. All right, so we're going to be talking about these different kinds of synapses and receptor proteins in subsequent chapters, right? And maybe you're going to really see where they're used in the body for glucose regulation, blood glucose regulation, and other effects in the body. So I know when you first looked at that G protein-coupled receptor for that first test, you probably had no idea why we wanted you to know that. Okay, well, now we got a little bit more involved, because now you see that those G protein coupled receptors can cause the buildup of a second messenger inside the cell, causing metabolic changes inside the cell or voltage changes, graded potentials inside of the postsynaptic neuron. So we're going to be looking at that some more. All right, there was a couple other things on this neuron, but I need the neuron diagram. I don't think I have it in my computer. Okay, yeah. Like, for instance, we have an iPSP. What kind of ligand-gated channel can produce an iPSP? Can it be a nicotinic receptor or a muscarinic receptor? It's a muscarinic receptor, right? Because a nicotinic-type receptor is going to open up a sodium channel, which is always going to produce an excitatory postsynaptic potential. All right, so I think that's on your slide as well. So EPSPs are produced by nicotinic-type ligand-gated channels. So where would you find nicotinic ligand-gated channels on the diagram over here? Receiving end or sending end? Receiving end, because that's going to produce a graded potential. That's where you have graded potentials, right, on the receiving end of a neuron. And a muscarinic receptor, let's just say that it's going to produce iPSPs by opening up potassium or chloride channels, for instance. What else did I miss on this slide right here? Axon hillock. Ooh, axon hillock in parentheses. What's the job of the axon hillock? Integration. Yeah, maybe describe that integration step. What's happening there? What's it integrating? The axon hillock can produce an action potential based on a lot of information coming to the axon hillock. What's the nature of the information coming to the axon hillock? And it can be excitatory or inhibitory. It's what? Those graded potentials? What are the two kinds of graded potentials? Those that cause depolarization. Those that cause depolarization are what kind of graded potentials? Are they excitatory or inhibitory? They're excitatory, so they're EPSPs, right? So EPSPs go to the axon hillock. But what other kinds of electrical information can get to the axon hillock? IPSPs, right? So the integration center or the axon hillock just sums up all of these graded potentials. The sum of all the EPSPs and IPSPs coming from all the dendrites and all the places on the soma and adds them all together, because graded potentials can do what? They can summate. And if threshold voltage is reached, then the axon hillock makes a decision to send an action potential down the axon. All right, so that's what's important right there. What else do I want to say? Yeah, know something about saltatory conduction versus continuous conduction. Okay. Those are all those nice question marks right there. And I think that's all I want to say. So who's got a question? Okay, say it one more time.
Is the threshold potential always the same?
You know, it's probably modulated some under certain circumstances. Maybe different nervous system pathways have a different threshold voltage. I think for this class, just say that the threshold voltage is constant. Okay, but there are probably under certain circumstances it can modulate up and down. And under pathological circumstances, maybe it can change quite a bit, right? Like body temperature. Body temperature has a set point, and it can vary a little bit depending on circumstances, but it should always be maintained in a range to support life, right? And if it goes beyond that range, then that's a disease state. So there might be some neuronal circuits where that threshold voltage does change, and maybe it produces a pathological state, and that can probably certainly explain affective disorders, schizophrenia, and things like that, but I'm not sure anybody knows any of that kind of stuff yet. Maybe somebody does. I don't know. Any other kinds of questions? So make sure you can draw, maybe you should be sure you can draw this neuron out and an action potential. Those are all good places to start to make sure that you have things all added up together in your mind correctly. Just from on a blank piece of paper, make sure you can draw an action potential out. Should I give you some more questions? What are the two phases of an action potential? Yeah, depolarization and repolarization. What does depolarization do to? Sodium channels open up, and a lot of sodium rushes inside the cell. Why does sodium rush inside the cell so fast? Concentration gradient and the voltage gradient as well, right? Just pulls a lot of sodium in, and when sodium goes in, that reduces the negative charge inside the cell, causing depolarization, right? So we call that a sodium current. So it's a flow of sodium, and sodium is charged, so it's like an electrical current as well. And repolarization, what's that do to? Potassium channels. So now potassium leaves the cell, so the inside of the cell becomes more negative as every potassium ion leaves. And what is something special that happens right at the peak of an action potential? And I want you to relate that to the membrane, the sodium channel protein. The inactivation gate slams closed, right? And that starts a certain period in the action potential or in the neuron. What does that start? The absolute refractory period, and so that prevents action potentials from summating with each other. Yeah.
You said that the inactivation gate closed at the peak, but yeah. In our last papers it said it closed at zero, and there was no more inactivation.
Oh, really? I'd have to look at your lab and see. Okay.
But you want us to.
I like at the peak. I like at the peak. And different cells might have different set points for when that inactivation gate closes. All right. Okay, so we say that signal, here's a pretty good question. We said that signals, this will test your thinking about a synapse. Oh, what is a synapse again? What is a synapse? Yeah, it's a structural and functional unit of communication between cells, right? And you should know two kinds of synapses, two general kinds. Electrical, which require what kind of membrane protein? Gap junctions that allow sodium to go from one cell to the other, causing depolarization of the second cell. And the second kind of synapse is a chemical synapse, which is mostly what we've talked about in this chapter. All right, a chemical synapse. So what's the general name of a chemical that's used to transmit information across the synapse? Neurotransmitter. And do you know any names of some specific neurotransmitters? Acetylcholine, very common. Okay, norepinephrine, serotonin, right? Dopamine. What about some inhibitory neurotransmitters? GABA, glycine, that's an amino acid neurotransmitter. All right, so signals can go from what I don't have diagrammed right here, the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell. Right? Information can flow from presynaptic to postsynaptic, but can information flow from the postsynaptic cell back into the presynaptic cell? And maybe I should diagram that, right? So here is the presynaptic cell right here, right? Dendrite, cell body. Now, you're really confident with that answer, right? So we say information flows like that. Why can't it not flow backwards? Ooh, and that will really kind of stimulate your thinking. Why can't it flow backwards? I've got two reasons. Who has a good reason? Or you might have a good reason. Why can't it flow backwards? How does information flow across the synapse as a chemical? Oh, perfect. All right, don't forget. We're talking about a chemical synapse. So a chemical has to be released by the presynaptic cell, and it has to go to the postsynaptic cell. There's only one cell of these two that has the neurotransmitter. What cell has the neurotransmitter? The presynaptic cell. So the presynaptic cell can only send information because that's the only cell that has the neurotransmitter. But let's just say that the postsynaptic cell did have a neurotransmitter. The signal still couldn't go backwards. Why is that? I think I heard it over here. Because in order to be sensitive to that neurotransmitter, what does a cell have to have? A receptor. And what cell has a receptor? Only the postsynaptic cell has a receptor. So that's a second reason why information can only go in one direction. Okay? Can only go from pre to post, because the post has a receptor and the pre has the neurotransmitter. So information doesn't go backwards. All right? Raise your hand if you want me to go over that once again.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. The question is, how come signals can only go from the presynaptic into the postsynaptic cell? Or from what? Mr. Green to Mr. Blue right here? How did I do? Pretty good. Information can only flow in that direction. And the answer is, what is the form of that signal across the synapse? It's a chemical, which we call neurotransmitter, like acetylcholine. Which cell can release neurotransmitter? Only the presynaptic cell. Right? So only the presynaptic cell can send a signal out. All right, but in order for a cell to be sensitive to that neurotransmitter, what does the receiving cell have to have? A receptor. And which cells have receptors? Only the postsynaptic cell. Right, so that's the second reason why. Okay, only the postsynaptic cell has receptors. Now, you might learn exceptions to that rule in the next 20 or 30 years or something, so you're going to have to keep an open mind, right? Since this is science, you should always challenge authority and keep learning, but this is a good place to start, right? The presynaptic cell is the one that has neurotransmitter that can send a signal, and the postsynaptic cell is the one that has a receptor, can receive that signal, and so therefore signals can't go backwards. So that means that can a motor neuron ever be a sensory neuron? No. So one way of saying that is because of the one-way flow of information across the synapse. The cell can't send information both ways because of these synapses. That's one reason why. The other reason why is because action potentials can only go in one direction. So why can an action potential only go in one direction? From the axon hillock down to the axon terminus. That's another brain teaser. And that's because of refractory periods, right? That absolute refractory period. And graded potentials are never developed down there in the axon terminus. All right, so that's another way of thinking of that. All right, so you learned a lot about a neuron. Probably you didn't know a neuron was so important in your body. It makes all these decisions for you because it can integrate up graded potentials. Okay, another thought would be, what causes release? What's the signal that causes release of neurotransmitter from this axon terminus right here? Yeah, there has to be a calcium signal that enters the axon terminus. All right, and I don't know if I mentioned this last time. Where else do you have calcium playing an important part in your body? Structurally, you need it for bones, right? And as we get older, we all lose calcium in our bodies. Right, and your body has to make a decision, what's more important, strong bones or synaptic transmission? And if you could tell your body what to preserve, what would you preserve? Synaptic transmission or your bones? And your body makes that decision for you, right? And so what does that produce? That's one of the reasons why osteoporosis occurs. Of course, there are fundamental reasons that maybe we would like to treat, but that's one of the reasons, right? Calcium is important in many other places in your body, not just in bones. All right, so how can you protect yourself from osteoporosis? Make sure you have adequate calcium in your diet, plus vitamin D so you can absorb it, right? And then how can you make your bones bigger and stronger? Exercise, right? How can you make a muscle bigger and stronger? Exercise the muscle. How can you make your brains bigger and stronger? You have to exercise, yeah. And proper diet probably plays a role as well in terms of what? What do you need in your diet? You need essential amino acids like tryptophan and tyrosine to make those neurotransmitters. Okay, so don't starve yourself over the weekend. That would not be the right time, especially the Atkins diet. Because what would you do with an Atkins diet over the weekend? Yeah, you'll give yourself like an artificial case of diabetes. You're going to starve your cells of glucose. You won't be able to make ATP, and you'll be really dingy. You might not even find your way to the test on Tuesday, right? Like driving on the wrong side of the road. Okay. All right. So have a nice weekend. The sign-in sheet is around someplace. Oh, question. Hold on. This might be like a really good question. Life-saving. Yeah. I'll bring your ID, too. A Fullerton or Cypress College picture ID. I can't remember if you need a calculator or not, so please bring one. Okay. And have plenty of tryptophan and tyrosine in your diet.
I know for the study guide you had us read the entire chapter, but I know you didn't lecture on the endocannabinoid, but